welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your co-hosts, Katie Halper.
And I'm Aaron Matek.
How you doing, Aaron?
I'm fine, Katie. How are you?
I'm good. I heard you binge-watched Ozark?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay, that's some misinformation. Let me clarify that.
I did start watching. I just haven't finished it.
Right. So definitionally you haven't binge-watched it or else you'd be done.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
I started watching the first episode.
Of the new second half of the new season.
Yeah, so I guess that's episode 8 of season 4.
Okay.
Yeah. Didn't get full way through, but that was just because I was tired. And I'm trying to take care of, be better about sleep hygiene.
That's very important.
Very important.
Especially if you have shows in your life like Ozark, which entail so much murder, you know,
violence.
Just human malice.
Right.
It's important to be well rested to
process handle, that.
Yes.
Yeah. To handle and not get inspired by it.
Mm-hmm. Very important. Yeah.
What do you think of it?
Well, I'm only on the first half of the last season, so.
Did you do that strategically so you wouldn't have to be like tortured by waiting for the second half?
No, there's nothing strategic. I just, you know, there's a thing called global injustice suffering, and that's my main concern.
That's your focus, right?
That's my main concern. Right. Not binge watching Netflix shows. Yes.
Right. I see. So yeah. Right, but you are binge watching it. You're just a little behind.
I'm just behind. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, she's the woman who plays Ruth is great.
Oh, fantastic actor.
She's so good.
So good.
And I actually really enjoyed the show on Netflix, Inventing Anna, that she's in.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Everyone's talking about Severance, too. Have you seen that?
No. And what is it?
It's Ben Stiller directed it. And everyone loves it. Okay. Everyone says it's great. Yeah.
It's a comedy or
it's not a comedy.
Sci-fi?
I think it's like a dystopian workplace drama or something. I don't know. I haven't seen it, but everyone says it's great.
Well, we'll look into it. And Ben Stiller, you're welcome on the show. Because Aaron and I are both huge fans of a film of yours called Flirting with Disaster.
Flirting with Disaster. Honestly, so I think it's my favorite movie of all time.
It's really good.
Yeah. If I were to, certainly my favorite comedy. I love that movie so much.
It's up there for me. Yeah. Patricia Arquette, before I knew how much I hated her.
Yeah. Patricia Arquette, before she blocked me on Twitter.
Oh, she blocked you. Interesting.
Also a great performance. It was some Russiagate stuff.
See, we're so fair and balanced because there are other people who wouldn't acknowledge what a good performer she is because they didn't like her. But we do. Her politics suck and she's a good actress. Good actor.
You know, unfortunately for me, in the Russiagate era, saying like the line, their politics suck, but they're very talented at whatever they do. That's become a common refrain, unfortunately. Yeah, that's what it is.
Right. You know? She very boldly said that, what was it? That Russia should be kicked out of NATO. Did you see that?
Really? Well, so I missed that because I'm blocked, but
right. Apparently. Yeah. Oh, because you're blocked. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think she meant the UN, which also is probably not advisable, but whatever.
Yeah. By the way, you know, what's funny is if Russia was in NATO, then we wouldn't even be having this whole mess.
Right. Of course.
Actually, Russia wanted to join NATO at some point because they wanted to have a European-wide security architecture so that no one's pitted against each other. No one, by definition, is an adversary because everyone's in the same military alliance rather than a military alliance that excludes some people. And so, you know, really, if Patricia Arquette's vision of a Russia inclusive NATO had come to fruition, then we wouldn't be in this problem.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe she's actually a visionary.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Well, that's been our pop culture segment for the week.
We hope
you enjoy it.
Yeah. That's your one-stop shop for culture, everybody. You just got caught up.
Culture. Yeah, you got caught up. Everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know what? Let's call it a show. Let's just wrap. Call it a
okay,
let's
okay,
wrap
fair
it.
Enough.
That's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
See you guys next week.
Yeah. Well, you know, Katie, the key to any balanced lifestyle is having a mix of everything. So you have your culture. We covered that.
You also
need your four basic food groups.
Exactly.
And luckily, we had that for you, too.
You're so in luck. Yeah. Let's hit it.
So four basic food groups for anyone who's unfamiliar, it's a regular segment we do on the show. It's Democrats suck, Republicans suck. Isn't that weird? Isn't that terrible? So this week I have...
Because that's what all news is broken down into, basically.
So for Democrats suck this week, what is the big issue right now for Democrats? Obviously, it's this leaked Supreme Court draft that would overturn Roe versus Wade.
Right.
So how did Joe Biden respond to that? Well, he visited a Lockheed Martin plant in Alabama to talk about his top priority, which is continuing the proxy war in Ukraine. He's just asked Congress for $33 billion, including $20 billion for weapons for Ukraine. And here's a little bit of what he said.
They can hit targets up to 400 meters away and have a fire and forget capability. That means a person firing can, I know you know, but it's for anybody who maybe listen, can change positions or take cover before that javelin even strikes home, strikes the target. In fact, they've been so important, there's even a story about Ukrainian parents naming their children, not a joke, their newborn child, Javelin or Javelina, not a joke.
Okay, so that's a bit hard to understand because he's very soft-spoken there, to right. put it nicely. But what he's touting is the Javelin missile, okay, at this Lockheed Martin plant. And he's relaying an anecdote that parents in Ukraine of newborns are so grateful to the Javelin missile being provided to them by the all-generous U.S. weapons arms industry, that they're naming their kids Javelin and Javelina. That's what he said.
I mean, it has a nice ring to it.
I love, yeah, I love, you know, thinking of children as symbols, tokens of instruments of death. That's
right.
That's what I think of when I think of children.
Yeah. What are other good names that we could come up with from weapons? We already have Atom, like the Atom bomb.
You Atom bomb. There we go. That's brilliant. Yeah. Yeah.
Atom, A-T-O-M. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. How about calling a kid Stinger for a Stinger missile?
I like that.
Hey, Stinger.
I mean, Stinger's cute, and then you call him Sting for short, and
you call him Sting. There we go.
Maybe that's who Sting was named after.
That must be it. Boom. That's his origin story right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
Fun fact, everybody: Pop Star Sting is named after the Stinger missile.
Yeah. He chose that name himself, and he went with that. That's what inspired him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that's Joe Biden. That's his top priority right now, is going to a Lockheed Martin plant, asking for $33 billion more for Ukraine at a time when unemployment, hunger, all these problems that the U.S. is facing are ever present. And this is his priority, and relaying anecdotes about Ukrainians naming their kids after U.S. weapons. Very touching.
Well, the good news is that now with Roe v. Wade basically under threat of being overturned, and it will be overturned shortly, barring some major unexpected changes, the good news is you may not be able to terminate a pregnancy, but now you have some cool names that you can choose from, like Javelin and Javelina, if you want to be in solidarity with the people of Ukraine. So it's always a silver lining.
And a very creative solution to the new problems created by the Supreme Court.
Right. Stingers. Guys, let us know on Twitter. Use the hashtag UsefulIdiotsPod and let us know some other weapons-inspired names that you think would be good. And we'll read them next week.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
All right. So for Republican suck, we have the major development that Aaron referred to, which is a leaked Supreme Court draft opinion published Monday night by Politico shows that the Supreme Court has voted to overturn abortion rights. The document is an internally circulated majority draft opinion that was written by Justice Samuel Alito that would strike down Roe v. Wade. As people probably know, Roe v. Wade guarantees federal constitutional protections of abortion rights. And in this decision, Alito writes, quote, Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. We hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled. It is time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives. One of the things that's so disingenuous about this quote and this framing is that it makes it seem like, oh, we need to make this a Democratic issue, put it into the hands of the people. The thing is, though, that this is minoritarian rule. This is a Supreme Court deciding the fate of countless people and overruling majority will, popular will, because the right to abortion is actually overwhelmingly supported by people. You'd never know that because the loudest voices in the room are these crazy fundamentalists, and they do things like play with take out plastic fetuses and do all that stuff and kill doctors, harass women who are getting abortions. But the truth is, again, the right to an abortion is overwhelmingly supported by the American people. So this is just an ideological dictatorship hiding as popular will. And they're also full of shit because, like, Kavanaugh was saying it was decided, you know, it was precedent. All these people who pretended during their confirmation process to never, you know, that they wouldn't overturn Roe are doing this. And Alito also is a coward. He wouldn't say what his thoughts on Roe were. They're a bunch of cowards, and they're a bunch of ideologues pretending to be fair and balanced, neutral interpreters of the Constitution and the law. But they're ideologues, and there should be term limits for them. So yeah, a bunch of fossils. So that's already Republican sucking. But then I want to highlight a special Republican who sucked on this issue, Matt Gaetz. He writes, how many of the women rallying against overturning Roe are overeducated, underloved millennials who sadly return from protest to a lonely microwave dinner with their cats and no Bumble matches? Well, okay, Matt, I'm allergic to cats, so it doesn't apply to me. I may be overeducated. I don't do Bumble. Not that there's anything wrong with it. I don't know what overeducated means. Probably any woman who goes to school at all past, like, nursery school is overeducated for Matt Gaetz. But this, to me, is just reveals how personalized. It's real projection. That's what we're seeing here. And clearly all of Matt Gaetz's politics are based on his own insecurities. I don't want to come off as a size queen or be ableist or anything, but I can't help but think that there's some penis size insecurity that shapes his politics, hatred of women, issues with his mom, issues with other women in his life. I guess I want to thank Matt for kind of opening up about how personalized his politics are, how he's dealing with a lot of darkness and sadness. And I kind of consider this, although on the superficial level, this probably looks like just your average typical right-wing misogyny. I think there's actually a call for help underneath this. This is where the healing could begin for Matt.
Absolutely. If you feel compelled to broadcast so much bitterness and anger towards women, obviously you're asking subconsciously for help. Because why else would you want to air such a hateful message? It's just so spiteful. And especially if you're an elected official.
Yeah.
I mean, have some sense, have some dignity.
Have some dignity, yeah. But also go talk to someone about your own online dating tragedies.
Yeah.
That clearly shaped the way you view politics.
Sure.
And I'm sorry that people didn't write you back on Bumble. Or didn't write you, because I guess Bumble's the one where women take the initiative first. So, which he must hate. He's probably so triggered by that. I wonder what his dating online profile would say. Anyway, that's another thing that viewers of the show, listeners of the show, let us know. Hashtag Useful Idiots Pod, what you think. But underloved millennials. Does he know that women of other ages besides millennials care about this issue?
Yeah, it's true. Why is he singling out millennials? He must have, as you say, he must have had some.
Yeah, he's been rejected by them.
Yeah. I just keep thinking that, you know, there's a Tupac song that really explains our entire world right now, the two top issues in the US, at least right now. First, he says, in Keep Your Head Up, he says, they got money for war, but can't feed the poor. We've quoted that line before in the show. But he also says in that song, he says, and since a man can't make one, he has no right to tell a woman when and where to create one.
Wow.
Yeah.
Remember that, Matt. I wonder if he likes Tupac.
He probably does.
He probably would deny it, though.
Yeah. That's a stark case of Republicans suck, as it always is. They never cease to suck.
Yeah. But let me just tell you something, ladies. Some good news for you guys, ladies and trans men. The good news is that no more of these back alley abortions, no more coat hangers. We got alternatives, medical abortion pills, and we'll talk more about those. But those are a possibility. So make sure you stock up on those ahead of time. Even if you're not planning to have an abortion, A lot of abortions are unplanned. So I'll put a link to the medications that you can take. Apparently, it's fairly easy. You just take two pills.
All right. So for Isn't That Weird, we have a medical procedure that is coming into vogue for, especially among men. It's very, 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 very relevant to me. And it's a headline from BuzzFeed News, which says he was 5'7". After surgery, he'll be 5'10". Originally designed to correct mismatched length in legs, limb lengthening surgery has become more popular for men looking to permanently increase their height. When I first met Scott, not his real name, in early March, he was gently pushing a walker ahead of him. I had gotten lost trying to find the door to his apartment, so he had to come find me. Leaning against the doorframe in a fitted t-shirt and shorts, he waved me over and then steadied himself. On a picture-perfect Los Angeles day like this one, had the circumstances been different, we probably would have met outside and enjoyed the sunshine. But he's still getting used to his new legs. A few weeks earlier, Scott had what he calls life-altering surgery. He underwent a procedure that will make him permanently taller. There are no concrete numbers on how many people are having this procedure, but Scott is among the men who, frustrated by how they're treated because of their height, sought out a surgeon who could permanently lengthen his legs. Before the $75,000 procedure he had in January, he was about 5'7". By the time he's done lengthening, a weeks-long process after the surgery, he will be 5'10", about an inch taller than the average American man. Well, listen, this is a very relevant article for me because I happen to be on the short side as well. And Wilson, I don't know, did you see me tweet about this article itself before you picked it, or is that just coincidence?
I did not. I didn't know you tweeted this.
And this is what I said in response to this article when it came out. If anybody can spot me $75,000, I'll pay you back in spades if this procedure helps me become global supreme emperor. Consider it. And, you know, what I mean there is, like, you know, every short guy has this fantasy of what life could be like if they were just a little bit taller. I mean, that's that Skilo song. I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller. You remember that song? And so my joke forever for, you know, with my family and friends has always been like, you know, if I was like taller, I wouldn't even be hanging out with you guys right now. I'd probably be like president or global supreme emperor.
Right.
You know, so that was so, but that's like, no doubt, any man in a similar situation who saw this article, I'm sure had similar thoughts. So I know for some people, this procedure sounds very, very weird, and it is weird, but at the same time, it sounds kind of awesome too, to me.
Would you do that surgery? What if you actually, your like fundraiser call is successful? Then what?
If I could be 3 inches taller, I absolutely would do it. But spending $75,000, you know, when you think about what else could be done with that money,
right?
It's pretty selfish, I think. You know, it seems tacky.
Right.
But I get it. I'm not judging anyone who's done it. Who knows? Maybe one day I'll be in a position to do it. Who knows? But and I also believe you have to, you know, there's some peace in accepting how God made you, you know?
Right. Of course. Yeah. You know, you have a great life. Imagine if you had changed it. You'd be supreme emperor, but
yeah. In this anti-short king world.
Right.
You know, even a 5'7" short king will feel short.
Right. Because of shorter phobia.
Yes.
Well, for Isn't That Terrible, we have a story about you'd never believe it, but apparently Amazon is making a decision that isn't good for workers. So Amazon workers won't get paid for COVID leave anymore. Amazon is cutting paid time off for frontline U.S. workers who test positive for COVID-19. All U.S.-based Amazon workers who test positive for COVID-19 will now get up to 5 days of excused unpaid leave. They are changing their policy, and obviously this will be bad for not only workers with COVID, but workers in general, people in general, because people are going to be spreading COVID more than they would have been under the previous rules. Also, workers waiting for COVID tests results will no longer have time off excused since rapid tests are now widely available. Of course, we know that rapid tests are not as reliable as the PCR tests. This is not surprising, but it's still terrible, I would say.
Well, I'm sure, what's his name? Jay Carney, the former White House press secretary under Obama, will have a great explanation for why this is totally fine.
Yeah. Somehow it's going to be. Somehow they're the ones who are believing in science. I'm not sure how it works, but somehow he, as a Democrat, is pro-science.
Yeah.
But when Republicans make decisions like this, they're anti-science. Don't know how it works, but somehow it comes out to be that way. Yeah.
And speaking of Amazon, Chris Smalls, the labor organizer who won Amazon's first union effort, he's now meeting with Bernie Sanders, with AOC. He's even been invited to the White House, apparently. So, you know, he's making moves and he's doing something that this country really needs. And so, you know, I don't know. Shout out to him.
Yeah, seriously. Got to get him on the show.
So this week we have a great guest. Manar Adli is the founder and editor of Mint Press News, which is a news outlet that focuses primarily on U.S. foreign policy. There's very critical journalism of U.S. policy around the world, from the Middle East to Ukraine. And right now they're among a growing list of independent journalist outlets that are being targeted. And now they're being targeted in the form of financial sabotage, basically, where PayPal has blocked access to their account. PayPal's done the same thing to another adversarial website called Consortium News. So we're going to hear from Manar about that, as well as all the reporting that Mint Press does.
And without any further ado, let us hear from Manar Adli. So thank you so much for joining us. I want to know how you learned about what PayPal did to Mint Press, and if you could just talk about what they did and also how you found out about it.
Well, I was contacted by PayPal via email. I received an email last week, basically telling me that my PayPal account, I basically could not use our PayPal account anymore, and PayPal is no longer offering their services to myself or to Mint Press. And the only reason given was this one line vaguely stating that our account poses risk and therefore they are permanently banning us, and that any funds that we have in our PayPal balance would be held for about 180 days. And after the 180 days, they would decide at that point if that money would be returned to myself and Mint Press. Unless, of course, part of that investigation, you know, any funds that would go towards that investigation, they would pull out of our balance. So it definitely sounded like they were about to steal our money.
So they were going to charge you for whatever funds that they used to investigate you.
Yeah, that's right.
And also Alan McLeod was targeted, right? Mint Press journalist Alan McLeod?
Yeah, for Mint Press, it was myself, the Mint Press business account, Alan McLeod, and from my understanding, other independent media outlets and journalists like Consortium News and Caleb Maupin were also targeted. And, you know, this sort of seizure and banning by PayPal, I believe, is blatant censorship of dissenting journalists and outlets who have unapologetically worked as watchdog journalism outlets to expose the profiteers of the permanent war states. You know, if we look at PayPal, we're not the first that have been targeted by this campaign. You know, we live in an intellectual no-fly zone right now, where online censorship has become the norm of dissenting journalism. But the blueprint of this was actually created in 2011, I believe, when WikiLeaks and Assange were targeted by PayPal to ban them from receiving any sort of funds or donations to their outlet. And there's no question that that was a direct order from the US government and possibly from the Department of Homeland Security. And if you remember, in 2012, an EU parliamentary resolution criticized providers like PayPal for this arbitrary economic censorship. So there's no question that those who have been exposing the profiteers and the agendas of the permanent war state, from the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, to Israel's occupation of Palestine and Saudi Arabia's genocidal war in Yemen, which is the kind of coverage that we provide. And we also work to expose the regime change operations in Syria, Ukraine, and Venezuela, and how, you know, weapons flows are to these nations have plunged them into devastating civil wars. And so there's no question that PayPal is working hand in hand with the US government, with the national security state, with the military industrial complex to target dissent. And if you look at PayPal themselves, they're actually a partner of the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, which is an anti-dissenting organization that you know, purports that it is fighting anti-Semitism, when in fact it is a purveyor of racism and targets Palestinians and anybody who really questions you know, mainstream corporate war narratives. I mean, they famously went after Ilhan Omar, but they also are responsible. They also work with YouTube. They're also responsible for these big tech giants, including PayPal, for preventing Palestinian Americans from accessing their own money on these accounts. So we're certainly not the first, but this definitely sets a dangerous precedent for independent dissenting journalism.
They also, by the way, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which really, as you said, has nothing to do with defamation. They went after, they tweeted their, president tweeted something critical of Matt Taibbi because Taibbi wrote an article about Josh Gottheimer, which mentioned the fraternity he belonged to at Harvard. And Matt didn't even know it happens to be a Jewish fraternity. But the point is, it's a fraternity with a lot of powerful people in it, totally unrelated to the fact that it's Jewish. But it just totally weaponizes anti-Semitism to, and actually I would say really is aids anti-Semitism in a way, because it trivializes it to such an extent that when there is actual anti-Semitism, it's taken less seriously. And it's not focused on because there's so many kind of garbage allegations of anti-Semitism describing things that are not anti-Semitism.
Absolutely. I mean, the weaponization of anti-Semitism has prevented any sort of real critical dialogue of the state of Israel and its apartheid policies against Palestinians and its oppression of Palestinians, its occupation of Palestinian land, its theft of Palestinian land. I mean, look at what happened last year in May during Israel's onslaught of Gaza that left 70,000 people homeless after it leveled all of Gaza. I mean, the amount of bombs that it had dropped leveled out all of these buildings in Gaza, targeted residential homes, and it you know, and Israel targeted buildings housing journalists. And we weren't even allowed to talk about that because they weaponized anti-Semitism, any sort of criticism of Israel and its permanent war state and its genocidal policies will result in anyone being accused of being anti-Semitic or anti-Israel, whatever that means, while Palestinians continue to suffer under that regime.
Right. So also, I just wanted to put in that you are totally correct in what you said about PayPal and WikiLeaks. And Bronco Marchetich has a great article in Jacobin about what happened to Mint Press and Consortium News, in which he calls out the not only what PayPal did, but the total silence among corporate media, mainstream media, establishment media, legacy media, when it comes to covering this, even though it should be a huge story. He links to an article from 2010 about how PayPal said it stopped WikiLeaks payments on U.S. letter. PayPal has said that its decision to stop people from using its service to make donations to WikiLeaks was made after a letter from the U.S. government. A vice president at the online payments firm said the State Department had said that the activities of the website were illegal in the U.S., and PayPal suspended payments to WikiLeaks and has been followed by Visa, Europe, and MasterCard. Amazon and Swiss Bank Post Finance have also cut ties with WikiLeaks. This is kind of crazy. The PayPal's vice president, Osama Bedier, told a conference that the company's acceptable use policy group had decided to suspend WikiLeaks' account after the State Department sent a letter on 27 November, adding that it was a straightforward decision. Pretty amazing that they just admitted that part out loud. We don't always get to see that, like, straightforward explanation, but in this case, we did. But there's some good news, right? Aren't they giving you back the money in the account, or?
So yesterday, I received an email stating that we can now access our funds if we have a balance, and we can transfer those funds to our bank account, but we still cannot use PayPal services. Right. And then in the email, it was really strange. It actually stated that there are steps we can take to lift some limitations. No steps were provided. We don't even know what that means. I tried logging in today to our PayPal account and we still have the same big message appearing on the screen, which is you can no longer use PayPal permanently. So, you know, maybe it's a little bit of good news that we can finally get our, you know, any access to our own money, but it appears we still are banned from PayPal.
And again, they haven't told you why they've imposed this ban, right?
I mean, they just gave us that one liner, which is your account poses risk. What does that even mean? We don't even know what that means.
You know where this is going? I wouldn't be surprised if, I don't know, in like a year or two, 10 years, we'll get to a point where, say, like someone will be listening to a podcast like this where, you know, Minar's talking about, you know, US crimes from Syria to Ukraine, wherever. And all of a sudden, someone listening to the podcast will get a message being like, your bank account's been depleted because we've matched your podcast content to risky right. thoughts. So sorry, you've lost your bank account.
It's just
like what's the what? Obviously, I'm exaggerating, but it's like this is where it's just insane how normalized this has become. And what's your response, Minar, to, you know, Katie mentioned this, the lack of corporate media interest in what's happening to you right now. Everyone's sort of just greeting this with a shrug. But yeah, like sure, let's just freeze a independent news site's funding because we can.
I mean, why would they care? I mean, we're talking about the corporate mainstream media that acts as stenographers, as public relations for the permanent war state, who are constantly pushing a war agenda. They push, perspectives and statements that are directly manufactured by the State Department and the Pentagon. And so we can't expect any of these corporate media outlets to come to our defense. And I think it's so interesting that while we were being banned by PayPal the same weekend, there was the, you know, correspondence dinner taking place at the White House, where we have figures like Trevor Noah celebrating how we have the fourth state acting as a watchdog to those in power. That's complete bullshit. The mainstream corporate media acts as stenographers for the permanent war state. And we're seeing that taking place right now as we've entered wartime with the war in Ukraine. There is no critical coverage of US foreign policy or NATO that brought us the Ukraine crisis. There's no critical coverage of how, you know, while we are suffering here in America, people are lacking healthcare, our infrastructure is crumbling, we have a homelessness crisis, we have so many issues, student debt. And the Biden administration, instead of fixing the problems right here at home, is wanting to send billions of dollars of weapons to the Ukrainian military and government. I mean, our media is beating the drums of war. They're pushing this Russia phobia. They've been doing this for a long time. I know, Aaron, you've been covering that for a very long time with Russiagate. And our media is now acting as a lapdog and not a watchdog. And so why would they come to our defense when our media right now is also owned by the billionaire class? I mean, look at the New York Times, look at the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos and works directly with the CIA. Look at the Daily Beast, which, you know, formerly had Michael Wise. He's a senior fellow at the NATO-funded Atlantic Council who has been accused of running the very shady organization, that blacklisted independent media outlets and figures like Mint Press, who basically state that anyone critical of the Obama administration, critical of any sort of war narrative, is in fact a Russian disinformation agent. And so we have all of these very shady individuals and organizations that are tied to, you know, NATO-funded think tanks and, you know, like the Atlantic Council, and think tanks that work hand in hand with weapons manufacturers. They're funded by Israel, by Saudi Arabia, who are targeting dissenting journalists and anti-war figures. So there's no question what their agenda is. It's to smear and target any sort of dissenting voices.
One of those dissenting voices who's being targeted is the Pope. I don't know if you saw this, but in the Daily Beast, they just basically called the Pope a conspiracy theorist because he made the point that he thinks that NATO might have provoked the Russian war on Ukraine, that he thinks that if NATO had not tried to expand to Russia's doorstep, that this war possibly could not have happened. And for that, the Daily Beast called him a conspiracy theorist. So there it is from the Daily Beast. Pope Francis says NATO started war in Ukraine by barking at Putin's door. And it's labeled there under the category of conspiracy theories. And they say that in the article too. So that's just, I mean, even the Pope can get labeled a conspiracy theorist by the Daily Beast. So really,
way to go, Daily Beast.
I mean, you know, in fairness to them, at least they're not just punching at independent leftist journalists. They're even willing to go after the Pope for saying the wrong thing.
Yeah, they're fair and balanced.
Very fair and balanced. Yeah. So let me ask you, Minar, about more of what you guys are doing. You at Mint Press have a new article up that was written by one of your reporters, Alan McLeod, that's called The NATO to TikTok Pipeline. Why is TikTok employing so many national security agents? Talk to us about that.
Well, there's no question that TikTok is extremely influential with young people. I mean, it's a medium that reaches over 1 billion people worldwide. And so having control over its algorithm or content moderation means the ability to set the terms of global debate and decide what people see, hear, and read, and what they don't get to see either. TikTok right now, since the war in Ukraine has taken a hold, TikTok has taken down at the behest of the US government, has deleted over 320,000 Russian accounts and removed 41,000 videos peddling so-called misinformation about the war. And they've also placed warning labels, just like Twitter, on Russia state-controlled media. And so why this is obviously very dangerous is that we have another big tech giant that now the US has control over to influence young people and plant the seeds of, you know, basically manufacture consent for war. We saw this taking place with other so-called neoliberal hipster style outlets like BuzzFeed and Vice News, who really present themselves to be friendly and hip and talk about, you know, drugs, sex, and fashion. And so they appeal to the younger crowd. But in a lot of their news coverage, they pretty much just rehash and republish State Department talking points. And in many cases, if you look at Vice News, they've actually been found through our coverage and through our investigations to just blatantly republish public relations statements and releases by the Board of Broadcasting Governors. And this is basically an arm of the US government to publish US propaganda. It's basically legalized propaganda that's funded by our US taxpayer money. And so now we have TikTok almost doing the same kind of thing, acting in the interest of the permanent war state of the Biden administration to ensure that young people are supporting an anti-Russian kind of agenda, a pro-war agenda, and to support NATO. And I think that's really, really important to talk about too, is that we're seeing now people on the left promoting NATO. I never really thought I'd see, be in a time where now the establishment left is just blatantly promoting NATO and weapons flows the way that they are doing right now.
I mean, what's even scarier, I think, and maybe more surprising, is that it's not just the establishment left, but in some cases it's the left that used to be or was more typically anti-war. We see voices like that even buying into the pro-NATO propaganda without really knowing what NATO is, I think.
Yeah, and I think the blueprint of this really didn't even start with Iraq or Afghanistan. I think it started with the war in Syria. I mean, the architects of the war in Syria did a really good job at creating what we now know as the so-called humanitarian interventions that were created by people like Samantha Powers, who famously presented all of these wars through a humanitarian lens to justify Obama bombs. Yet we know that Obama is the drone king. He bombed in his first term, I believe it was, he dropped over 25,000 bombs on foreign countries in Yemen, in Somalia. And so we have this permanent war state that, you know, through the Republican lens, it's being promoted, right? Just blatantly, like, we're gonna go bomb these countries, like how Trump said it, we're gonna carpet bomb these people. And the Democratic Party and the neoliberals present it more in a friendly light, like, you know, we have to go save these people from an evil dictator. And so that's how they promote their war agenda. So it is really scary because people who are younger now are starting to promote this pro-NATO agenda. And my son, who's now, you know, 12 years old, he's on TikTok. He actually told me, you know, when the war in Ukraine started, he said, "Mom, you know, I'm getting all of these alerts and these videos about Ukraine." He's like, "I've been on this, been using TikTok for a year. I've never seen any outrage for Israel's ongoing war in Gaza. I've never seen any sort of coverage about the people that are in Iraq or Afghanistan." This is my son, because, you know, he hears the things that I talk about. Right. And so at least he's aware because he has me influencing him. But a lot of these kids who only have access to these big tech giants and their parents, who probably consume news from the New York Times or the Washington Post, they wouldn't know what the difference between propaganda is and what real information is. And that's really the unfortunate thing.
Yeah, MinPress, you guys should do your own prop or not.
Well, and we kind of already do that through the fantastic reporting of, you know, Alan McLeod, you know, when he does his investigations. I mean, if we look at TikTok right now, they their content policy lead for TikTok Canada, Alexander Corbell. He's also the vice president of the NATO Association of Canada. So it's a NATO-funded organization chaired by former Canadian Minister of Defense, David Colinette. So there's a huge conflict in interest between these big tech giants and the way that they are trying to present or target, I guess you should say, information on their platforms.
You mentioned Vice News before. So can I show you guys one of my favorite Vice News clips? Like, there's so many. If you pick any, you know, global South country that's been targeted for regime change by the U.S., Vice News will have done a video advancing the U.S. state line, without exception, I think. Now, doesn't mean all their videos are bad. I've seen some good coverage from Vice News occasionally, but there's so many examples of just really funny propaganda. So I want to show you one of my favorites. This was when, if you remember this a few years ago, there was like this embassy standoff in Washington where after the Trump administration launched its coup attempt in Venezuela, its attempt to install Juan Guaido, it basically forced out the staffers at the Venezuelan embassy. And so the embassy staffers on their way out basically gave the keys to Code Pink and said, and some other activists said, "Protect the embassy for us." And then that's what these embassy protectors did, protecting it from the coup mongers who the Trump administration wanted to give the building to, right? So there was a standoff. So Vice News comes down and they do this segment where you have like a blockade of like pro-coup Venezuelan activists and their supporters in a standoff with Code Pink. And basically this Vice News segment tries to portray like Code Pink, which, you know, anybody who knows Code Pink, it's led by women, many grandmothers, you know, it's like, these are not like intimidating people to say the least, or violent people to say the least. It tries to portray them as like, you know, as like them, it's them intimidating the people who are blockading them and actually preventing food from getting in. Activists had to run through to just get food inside the embassy because they were being blockaded. So this is how Vice News reported it at the time.
Activists fight their battles through images on social media. The Venezuelans portrayed Code Pink as middle-aged white colonizers. Code Pink portrayed the Venezuelans as a mob of fascists. But Code Pink are pros.
A few days ago, we started noticing these people have been getting information, private information about our lives, and putting it out there as a means of, I guess, scaring us. It's becoming a little, you know, sketchy at this point. Creepy.
Do you think, in a way, Code Pink might have brought more attention to the suffering of people in Venezuela?
I don't know, because they've been having parties in the embassy. I don't really think they're spending their time talking to Congress people.
We tried to get inside, but the activists upstairs wouldn't let us in, saying we were the hipster media arm of the empire.
So I just love the clip because, like, they're basically portraying Code Pink as a collection of like sinister people who are endangering these noble activists outside, who are in reality blockading and harassing the people inside the embassy and doxing them and their word for their safety, when really it's the people inside the embassy whose safety was concerned. And then at the end, they have that line where the activists inside called them the hipster arm of the empire, which I think that clip gives a lot of evidence for.
Right. Yeah. Did they show all the people making like racist statements, racist, sexist slurs, the Venezuelan Americans doing that?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No.
Well, and they did this kind of thing with, you know, when I was talking about, they were just republishing press releases from the Board of Broadcasting Governors, which, by the way, provides press releases also to organizations like Voice of America, which is funded by the U.S. government. They were doing this with the war in Syria and the war in Ukraine during the first Maidan coup. They were promoting like the Obama administration's official narrative on the war in Ukraine and justifying the coup that was taking place there. And then also, you know, they used Islamophobia too to promote a U.S. agenda in Syria as well. So I think it's really unfortunate that their propaganda is so sophisticated that it's reaching these younger people.
Can you elaborate on what you mean when you say using Islamophobia?
Sure. They were interviewing women that were fully covered in black. And they do it in a very insidious way. You know, they are kind of showing these women wearing all black, fully covered, who are being so-called, you know, oppressed, but then also making it appear as if that is how Islam also allows women to be treated within the religion. So while, you know, showing the humanity, I guess, of girls that were being oppressed by Islamist groups like ISIS or Al-Nusra Front, they were also promoting the idea that this was actually the normal way in which Islam treats women, instead of actually going behind the propaganda and looking at that this is a Wahhabi way of life. And I found that to be really irritating when I was watching their coverage of, you know, inside of Syria.
Yeah, and that was like a broader thing with Syria, where if you basically were opposed to the U.S. policy of arming an insurgency dominated by al-Nusra, aka al-Qaeda, you could be called Islamophobic.
That's
right. Pointing out that most Syrians actually don't want to live under al-Qaeda. That was a common trope used, that somehow you're engaging in Islamophobic rhetoric. And actually, and the whole thing really, even this idea that Syria was this like religious war, Sunni versus Shia, was also a complete fiction too, because actually the majority of the Syrian military that was fighting these U.S. armed insurgent death squad, they were Sunni. So that also was a way in which to wage a disastrous dirty war.
They were absolutely pushing the sectarian narrative of the conflict like so many other media outlets. And the disappointing thing in that is that it kind of portrays Muslims as if they have been fighting, you know, it goes with that narrative that they've been fighting each other for thousands of years. And so it falls into creating that caricature, painting that caricature of Muslims as being backwards or barbaric and violent. When in fact, it is our means of overthrowing the democratically elected government in Syria, which is the means of barbaric and backwards.
Manar, you are a Palestinian American, right?
Yes.
So what is your reaction now to just recently in Israel-Palestine, you've had new Israeli attacks on worshipers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, this is after you had the assault on Gaza in which so many people were killed, so many homes and lives were destroyed. What is your sense right now of where the U.S. media is at in covering Israel-Palestine? Do you feel as if it's been a forgotten issue? How do you feel it's being covered, and do you think it's being done in any kind of remotely fair way?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com. That was great.
That was great. Really dangerous, ominous time right now where people who don't toe the party line are being cut off in the ways that MinPress and Consortium News are. And let me just put out a special plug to our tech overlords to please consider sparing us at Useful Idiots.
Please, yes. We will
try to be more subservient in the future if you let us continue talking out
loud. We'll do our best. Yeah, definitely. And make sure you become Substack subscribers in case anything does happen to us. We gotta be able to fight the fight.
Yeah, so we can keep in touch.
Also, you're gonna want to become Substack subscribers because there's a little tea, you know, not pouring tea. What, spilling tea? God, I sound so old. Well, how do we? There's some spicy criticism that we engage in during the Substack only portion of this interview.
Very spicy.
Yeah, very
so spicy.
Spicy.
Yeah, so spicy, my mouth is burning still.
Yeah, my eyes are watering. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so spicy, yeah. And of course, you can do that at usefulidiots.substack.com.
That was a great show. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. See you next week. Hello, thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday morning show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.